Mark Collier here with Fort Thomas Matters Radio. I'm here with Adam Meyer, Fort Thomas City Council candidate. We are doing the Informed Voters Project, which is sponsored by Omega Processing Solutions here in Fort Thomas. If you are a small business owner, you use credit card payments, processing solutions, anything of that magnitude, Omega Processing in Fort Thomas on Alexandria Pike is the place to go. Please check them out. We thank Omega Processing for sponsoring the Informed Voters Project. Once again, here, Mark Collier with Adam Meyer. Adam, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Mark.
Sure. Adam, I'm going to basically, you know, give you the floor a little bit for a minute or two. Introduce yourself to you've already done so on Q&A on FortThomasMatters.com. You have AdamMeyer.com, which talks about some of your initiatives. But for those of our voters and our listeners that have not heard those or read those before, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I have two kids, Colin, who is 4, Ellie, who is 2, my wife, Laura, and we've basically spent the last couple, I guess almost 2 years, renovating a two-family house here in Fort Thomas to kind of make that our dream home. I'm a attorney in training. I work for the federal government as a procurement or contracting officer, so I'm in federal procurement is my primary job. I was a political science major. I've always been really interested in local government, government at all levels, but now that I'm somewhere I know where I'm going to stay the rest of my life, I thought now would be a great time to get involved and kind of throw my name out there for city council. There were some openings, and I thought I was well qualified to do the job, and so I thought I'd go for it.
So you're hoping to bring a little bit of a fresh perspective. I mean, I'm reading your Q&As and on your projects on your campaign website, that seems to be the prevailing theme is a fresh perspective. You talked about you renovating your homes. That also seems to be, you know, one of your main priorities is home renovation, and you've got a tax abatement, the project that you'd like to see, you know, started in Fort Thomas. Tell us a little bit about what that's called. There's 4 prongs to it. Let's go through each one of them if we can.
Sure. So what I'm proposing is what I'm calling the Pretty the City Initiative. It's basically where there's a two-prong approach, one focusing on just vacant properties and how to address those, which I can come back to. The other prong is basically creating a tax abatement program or a tax moratorium program to incentivize certain properties, targeted properties, for tax moratoriums for a fixed period of years, depending on the type of property. So maybe we'll just go through kind of some of those types of properties. So one type of property that I would target, and this is a lot based on my own personal experience of what I've just gone through, but basically converting a two-family house into a single-family residence.
Which we have a lot of those in Fort Thomas right now.
Yes, there's a ton of them. And as you know, single-family housing is limited. It's finite. There's not a lot of property for development in Fort Thomas, if any. So it's a great opportunity to create more single-family residents, but really create a win-win for the city as well in that process. I'd like to do it in a revenue-neutral manner. So what I would propose, and let me talk about some of the reasons I think it'd be good first. For one, single-family residents will typically assess a lot higher per square foot than a multifamily counterpart. So with our renovation, once we were done, without increasing the square footage of the footprint, we increased the value significantly of the home. And so once that's reassessed, the city's going to realize additional tax revenues for that.
Down the road.
Yes. Yes. As soon as it's reassessed, because my plan's not in place yet, so there's no tax moratorium. So,
your plan would basically, propose for the city not to reassess that at the higher rate.
Correct. Yeah. And basically, it varies the number of years that I would propose. But say for like my house was a non-conforming two-family, meaning it was zoned for single-family residence, but it was a two-family home, and so what I've done is I converted it into a single family. So now it's conforming. It can't be changed back, you know, without a variance at least, which I don't see why they would, you know, give them at that point. So say I have a $150,000 or $200,000 two-family house that's assessed at $200,000. If I do, say, a $50,000 renovation, then you would only be taxed on that $200,000 value for the duration of that tax moratorium.
So I guess just to play devil's advocate here, you know, what would you say? I mean, a lot of people in Fort Thomas take a lot of pride. The homes are older, and a lot of people will do these types of repairs or renovations yearly anyway, smaller type things. Would those count in your plan?
At least not initially. I would prefer to target the two-family homes.
Sure.
Rather than the single family homes, because in the single family homes, you're right, there's going to be a lot of people that are already going to be doing those renovations. And so that could be a potential revenue loss for the city because that's already occurring. But with the two family homes, you don't have as a landlord, if you own that property and you're renting it to a couple families or a couple tenants, you don't have that same incentive to really fix up the property to make it really beautiful and do the extra effort. Like, you know, if you have to replace a furnace, are you going to spring for the high 95% efficiency of furnace, furnace, or are you going to just get the 80% or, you know, or just maybe spend $300 and fix it and just try and get a little more life out of it. So, same with landscaping. You just want to cut the grass. It's to maintain it as habitable.
Sure.
You know, and that's a business model, and I don't fault that. As a landlord, I would do the same thing, but I also don't have that incentive as a landlord to really make that extra effort and make it beautiful. But if I'm a homeowner and I'm fixing that up for my family, I'm going to make sure that I put all the effort because I'm planning on staying there.
And that's what you want. You want people to, you know, find these homes, renovate these homes, and stay in these homes for a long time.
Yeah, and you're going to get, you know, a little bit more involved residents, you know, when you have a homeowner who's vested in the community because, you know, he's not, you know, he's more
transient,
permanent.
Yeah, right.
He's not as transient. And, you know, and I was a renter for a large part of my life, and that in each of those stages, you know, I knew I wasn't staying there. You know, it was in college or law school or whatever, so I knew I wasn't staying there. So I didn't get involved in the community as much as I am now. So
you talked about it being a tax neutral type deal is what you're proposing. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of that, how that would work.
Sure. So basically, I'll take you through the process. So I have this two-family home that I just bought. I want to convert it to a single-family home. So I go get the engineer drawings and the architect drawings. I take them to the city's office. I say, I want to apply for a permit for this. So the city engineer looks at it. I would put a minimum on it. You know, I don't want the administrative burden of this program if there's not really a significant improvement. So say $10,000 or $15,000 minimum for the improvement. The city engineer, city inspector is going to, you know, they'll give you the permit. They'll look at it, make sure everything's looks good. The project goes forward. Once the final inspection's done, at that point, certificate of occupancy is issued and you freeze the assessment for the period. So I would propose around 7 or 8 years for a non-conforming two-family.
That'd be significant.
It would be. I mean, you're going to get through, I think it's reassessed every couple of years,
sure.
So you're going to get through a couple cycles of that. You know, and it's not a huge money, but again, if you, you know, if you say an example, the $200,000 home, you did a $50,000 renovation, if you tax it on that $200,000 value and leave out that $50,000 value, you know, you're probably going to save, I don't know, $1,400 over the course of 7 years on the city portion. I would also pass a companion resolution, or try to ask the school board to also recognize the tax abatement program for their portion of the taxes, because, as you know, it's a larger portion. And so if that was applied, you'd probably be looking at another $4,000
sure.
in savings.
The city and the school work so well together anyway. It's to me, looking at it as somebody that comments on Fort Thomas, that covers Fort Thomas, it's a fresh idea that frankly we need to see more of.
Sure.
So you talked about the multifamily, the non-conforming. Is there a commercial part of that that you're talking about with your Pretty the City initiative?
Yeah, I would definitely open it to really any commercial properties as long as they're properly zoned and conforming. You know, when you're in a commercial or retail situation, say you have a retail shop and you own this property and you're in the business district, and they leave for whatever reason, you want to replace that as quickly as possible. So you get somebody and say it's a barbershop or a beauty shop. Well, you're going to have to redo a lot of work. You're going to have to put plumbing in and sinks in, and you're going to have to invest in that structure. And so you're going to have a cash outlay in order to get that property filled. So as a resident, I want to see those properties turned over. Well, I don't want them to turn over, but when they're vacant, I want to see them, you know, filled. So
you don't want filler paper on the windows.
Correct. And you know, I also don't want to see, you know, stuff just turned into, you know, a couple of apartments or something like that in a business district. So, I would, again, offer a tax abatement program. For commercial properties, I'd probably do something around 5 years. That's usually the term of maybe an initial lease for something like that.
So 8 years on a non-conforming, 5 years on a commercial. Gotcha. And then the last part, the second prong of that, pretty the city, is the vacant properties.
Yes.
Tell us about, you know, what your plans are. Because obviously we're not, Covington has just had, got a lot of tax monies to raise a lot of vacant and blight homes. Fort Thomas doesn't have a ton of those homes, but they do have them.
Right. We're definitely not a blighted community. We don't have really even blighted sections. And I think that's what I noticed. I have two across the street from me. And it seems like every time I talk to a friend or meet somebody new, I'll talk to them about it. And they're like, yeah, we have one on our street, or we have two or three. You know, and some of these are, you know, stones throw away from the city building or whatever. And, you know, the city at this point, at least not to my knowledge, is not currently tracking the vacant property. So we really don't know the scope of the problem. But I can tell you there's not an insignificant number of these vacant homes. And I think a lot of times it might be, you know, an older family that, you know, they couldn't keep up on it and possibly passed away.
Sure.
The kids inherit it. And then they just don't do anything with it. At least that's what I've seen in a few circumstances. Every story is going to be different, but the main thing is that these homes that are vacant, you know, look at the VA homes, what happened to them over the last 10 or 15 years. Well, we don't want that thing happening all over the different streets in Fort Thomas. So, what I would propose is putting together a task force, and basically the task force first goal would be to just identify the properties and to find a way to track them. And so we identify them and track them. We put them on, say it's just a spreadsheet or whatever, maybe create an email address or have, you know, just make the public aware to call the city administration to report the properties.
Kind of like the potholes that you do. Yeah. Easy way to do it.
You know, and they can always, once they're reported, you know, we can check, at the city administration can check on them and make sure they're at least compliant with current ordinances, you know, their grass is cut and that sort of thing. But then taking it a step further, the task force, I would want to see maybe a couple of members of council and the administration, and then maybe some real estate professionals, maybe some lenders, and, you know, maybe a insurance, you know,
sure,
insurance rep, something like that. And maybe an at-large citizen or two, and basically people who are interested in turning these homes into, you know, restoring them to what they used to be. And so that committee, the Pretty the City Committee or whatever you want to call it, would basically, the next step would basically to find ways to incentivize those properties to be either restored or sold to somebody who will restore them. You know, one solution, again, might be a tax moratorium for, you know, qualifying improvements. So in order to combat, you know, people just saying, hey, my home's been vacant. So I would want it to be registered on that list.
Sure.
For at least, like, say, 12 months. You know, because somebody might move out, it might sit there vacant for 12 months, and at that point, they're obviously having trouble selling it as is. It might have some structural issues, whatever. So let's give them some sort of a tax incentive to help get that moving and get those properties back up to speed.
And again, it's the multifamily improvements, the commercial improvements, the vacant properties, and the non-conforming. The Pretty the City initiative, Adam Meyer, that's your shtick.
That's kind of what I've come up with. You know, I have some small other ideas. You know, I'd like to see more involvement in the city council meetings. You know, most of the time I go, you know, I might be
you've been
one
to
or two.
I've been
to several this year.
Yeah.
And I watched some on cable and stuff too. But I would like to see them on YouTube. And you know, it wouldn't be a very hard thing to do. We might even get the cable company might even do it for us, but it would be an easy thing to do. And for people that don't have cable, because a lot of people are, you know, they're pulling the cord or cutting the cord on cable, especially people maybe in our age, sure, age bracket. And the public, the cable sometimes hit or miss, it's not always on schedule. So this would give an on-demand way to stay informed with the city, you know, with the city. If you want to see the whole thing, you know, you might open Fort Thomas Matter, see, oh, they covered something I'm really interested in. Why don't I go to YouTube and check out the whole meeting and kind of skip the
whole thing. So it's just a way to more transparency, more access, more involvement.
Sure.
Those are good things in your mind.
I would think so, yeah.
Okay. Obviously, there's some other, your Q&A, just reading that. We did that back in March, I think. So let's tick down those talking points. The gun control resolution that was passed this year, your thoughts on that?
I mean, really, to me, that's not a city matter. I mean, guns aren't sold in Fort Thomas. It's a state-level matter. I personally don't like to see restrictions on the Second Amendment. And I really just don't think that's a matter the city should really be spending time on.
Sure.
So I obviously would have voted no. I've also been very vocal in saying that we're kind of wasting our time on this when it's not really a city matter. But it's an unfortunate situation that kind of spurred that right. conversation. Right. But as
a lot of, you know, terrible thing that happened, but a lot of, you know, legislation based out of panic is generally not a good thing.
Correct.
In my mind as well.
Yeah, I'm of the same mind on that.
The deer ordinance, anything to add to that? New, fresh, leave as is?
I would at least leave it as is. You know, I mean, we can reevaluate the population and see if it would have to be expanded or anything like that. But, I don't see any more effective way. There's no natural predators for deer. I think the ordinance was done in a manner that was safe. You know, it's safe to the public. And it's compliant with the state hunting laws and regulations. And so I think the city did the right thing there. I don't really have any groundbreaking strategies. I know this is coming up. It's probably the most dangerous season for deer. You know, they're going to be active. And so I would urge you to be cautious, especially on the Memorial Parkway and stuff like that. Keep an eye out and
yeah, just the education component, which, you know, was supposed to be part of this whole deer management solution. That's kind of been, you know, the stepchild, so to speak. And I think, to your point, more transparency, more communication. Obviously, deer season is the mating season coming up, yes, which means they'll be more active.
Yeah, and I know when my son was probably about 3 or 4 months, my wife hit a deer, and she was so shook up, and fortunately it didn't do, nobody was hurt, other than the deer. But it's a scary thing. And, you know, I think deer are beautiful creatures, but they're not more beautiful than my children. And,
sure.
It's definitely a safety issue, and it's a nuisance issue. And I think, really, I don't have any, like I said, I don't have anything groundbreaking to add, but I think it would need to stay in place at minimum.
You're on in the Woodfill School District right now. Mm-hmm. You're on the south side. You're over by the reservoir. Your thoughts on the fence? Would you, either want to see that removed? And if so, would you pursue that with the water district?
I'm sure it would be nice for those residents to have that walk, you know, that walking trail back. And but at the expense of taking on that liability for the city, I probably would not. I don't think it would be worth it. And I say that because we've, since that's been built, there's been such improvements to the parks here. The city's made a lot of efforts to create walkability and create paths and trails and dog park. And so there's all these great places to walk. And I can tell you that as part of my duties at EPA, I work with the Homeland Security Research Center, and there's a lot of nasty chemicals that they're testing these things that people can put in water.
Sure.
And it's there's some scary stuff out there. And, do I think the fence is really going to stop that if somebody really wants to do it? Probably not, but, you know, I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to do. And, you know, again, I don't think it's worth the liability the city would have to incur in order to make that happen. Again, it would be nice, but and I don't have any problem if the water district's willing to take it down at their own expense and their own liability. But, again, I just don't see it being the cost-benefit. You know, it doesn't add up to me to take that on.
Breed-specific legislation, your thoughts?
Well, let me make it clear that I am against dog bites. I don't think you're going to let me off with that, right?
No. All right. I don't think that we can stop that, though. You know, there's been, I think since 1998, there's been 19 reported dog bites in the city. So sure. Even with the ban in place, that's not going to stop. So.
All right. Well, since I can't snake out of that one. You know, obviously it's a touchy issue. There's very strong feelings on each side. I respect those feelings on each side. I respect the council's decision to kind of keep that in place while they address the dangerous dog ordinance. With that said, I probably would have voted a little differently. To me, I would have preferred to see a licensing requirement, bring the owners out in the open. Let's make sure that they have high liability insurance. Let's make sure that you know, they're vaccinated. Let's make sure that they're spayed or neutered, and do all the things that can mitigate the risk and basically create, because they do have, they're not a dangerous breed inherently, but they are a potentially dangerous breed.
Sure, as are most dogs.
As are many dogs. And to me, let's incentivize good ownership. Let's put a barrier to entry into ownership of that breed or really any breed that has that capability, to basically weed out some of the bad owners in advance. And then on the other end, so that creates a kind of disincentive for some ownership. But then on the other end, provide enhanced civil and criminal penalties for anybody who either gets caught with an unlicensed dog or two, has a bite from an unlicensed dog. So you know, you can create a licensing fee that is basically, you know, reasonable, say $100 or whatever per year. But then if they're caught unlicensed, you know, $400 or $500 and pound them, you know, you're going to weed out those bad owners. And, you know, is breed-specific legislation the best way to do it? Maybe, maybe not. I'm saying probably not. But is it a reasonable way? Anytime you have legislation, you're going to have to draw an arbitrary line. So when I go on the highway, is there a big difference between 70 and 71 miles per hour? Probably not a whole lot of difference to my safety. But an arbitrary line has to be drawn somewhere. BSL is one way to do that. You might be able to do it by weight. You might be able to do it, you know,
a percentage of mixed breeds, something like that.
There's ways to do it. But I think just taking this one small step to basically, let's focus on this dangerous dog ordinance and make sure that that creates a back end, you know, after there's a bite. But sometimes that's too late. So the advocates for keeping the ban in place want that preventive measure. So I think we can still have a preventive measure that's pretty much just as strong by creating that barrier of entry. And then, you know, at that point, it's going to allow a few owners who are responsible to have that breed. They're going to be responsible owners who are willing to take those steps because they love their dog and they, you know, they want to provide for their dog, but they also respect their neighbors enough to make sure that, you know, they keep their dog on a leash, they keep them fenced in, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And then, and then, you know, that's kind of a baby step and we can just kind of reevaluate and see how that goes. And, you know, maybe it's not one extreme or the other, but maybe that's a good compromise that the city could take. And then as people get more comfortable and they see them around, you know, they may realize that maybe they're not all dangerous. It's an education process.
Sure. And to your point, I mean, you look at communities that that do not have bans. So, you know, I look at places like Fort Mitchell, Indian Hill, Hyde Park, Sycamore. They have no bans, and they have no problems. Mm-hmm. And I think it's all got to be, you know, going kind of circling back to the deer thing, there's got to be an education component, mm-hmm. and that's got to be forefront.
Yeah, and I think I think the education's key. I think also it's just a matter of taking that step and basically testing it out, the water, stick your toe in the water, and see where things go. I think it'll be whatever you decide, there's going to be strong feelings either way. It's just one of those issues like the deer.
Well, the way it was decided right now, which is to not do anything, there were basically two camps, one that wanted complete removal and one that wanted the ban to stay in place. So obviously, with nothing being done, you're going to have everybody on one side upset. You're going to have everybody on the other side happy.
Right.
Maybe a compromise somewhere in the middle where everybody can walk away with something from the table. Responsible owners can feel like, they can walk their dogs and have these dogs and show that these dogs are no different than anybody else. The other side can feel a little bit protected in the fact that you're putting measures in place might be a little breed specific, but would still make them feel better, which is what Councilman Peterman talked about.
Right, and I think one thing that I would encourage is still attend the meetings, whatever side you support, let your voice be heard. But do it in a respectful manner. There was a few times I went to meetings and people got a little disrespectful towards the other side. And I don't think that helps your cause in any way. I think, I think it's a reasonable to have feelings on either side of that issue.
And at the end of the day, we're all neighbors.
Yes.
We live in a small community. And, whether or not you get your way on one thing or another, you're going to see these people out.
Yep.
You're a councilman, a candidate for councilman, but, that doesn't define who you are. Yeah. And
at some point, it's not if, but when, there's going to be a dog bite. It's just a matter of time. I don't know what breed's going to be the next breed. I know if it's a pit bull, it'll be very highly reported. If it's another breed, it may or may not be. But the dog bites are going to happen. You can't really legislate away all risk. Gun shootings are going to happen. These things are going to happen, and it's unfortunate when they do. But, I don't think rushing to the strictest, regulation is the best approach, at least in most cases. So
let's move on to the VA homes. And I want to kind of tie in, you were on a reality do-it-yourself show. I don't know. I've never done that myself. We're sitting here in my studio right now in my basement, which was redone by my father-in-law and my uncle-in-law. I'm not handy. You're handy.
Mm-hmm.
With your experience on the reality show on the Do-It-Yourself Network, what do you think about, can these VA homes be restored?
Yeah, I think they can. I don't know. I've never been in them. I'd love to be in them at some point, but I don't know how bad. I don't know how bad the structural issues are. As far as how bad's the basement leaking, or how bad is the supporting structures underneath. If they have to be jacked up or anything like that, that obviously is going to add significant cost to the project. I think they can be done, and I think they're important enough that the city will find a way to, or should find a way to, incentivize whatever needs to happen. Now, I think, right now we have developers who are looking at the project, and of course they're going to posture in a position to try and get the city to offer the moon, as far as incentives go. So I think, we take a slow approach, and, we put it out there. We try and recoup whatever costs we have in it. If the margins are really that thin, then nobody's going to bid on it, and we go back to the drawing board, and what can we add to the table? What we give a little bit. There's other approaches we could do. We could, if one developer is not willing to take that risk, we can allocate the risk and spread it to where you maybe open it up piecemeal, and you maybe have an open house for a week. You let potential owners come in with their own maybe their own builders. If you have a bonding, you can put a bonding requirement in place to ensure that all of the requirements are met as far as the historic district preservation guidelines and all that stuff. So, you know, there's always ways to get the goals. And I think that's one thing that I can bring to the table. I have really good problem solving ability. I like a challenge. And if there's a will, there's a way. And I think there's definitely a will in the city. They're very desirable properties. And so, you know, people might be willing to pay a little bit more than the market value or what market value might be deemed by an appraiser because, you know, because they're special homes.
Yeah, the city, they're iconic. And yeah. You kind of touched on this a little bit, but I'm going to give you a minute here. Your elevator speech, you and I are in an elevator. We've got 60 seconds together. Adam Meyer, you're running for Fort Thomas City Council. Why do I vote for you?
Well, I tell you, I moved here because this is the greatest place to raise a family. And I'm running to keep it that way. I want to ensure that the city stays beautiful. All those things that attracted me to it. I mean, we got great location. We got great schools. But there's always room for improvement. There's room for more beautiful homes. There's room to improve our schools and the quality of life here. You know, and I think there's ways to do that in a fiscally responsible manner. And I think I have the tools and the know-how to do that.
Well, Adam Meyer, it's a pleasure talking to you. If you want to see Adam Meyer's Q&A, you can go to FortThomasMatters.com, go to the Election 2014 tab, click on that, and you will be able to view his Q&A responses online. For Adam Meyer, this is Mark Collier for the Informed Voters Project, once again sponsored by Omega Processing Solutions. Omega Processing Solutions, stalwart in the community. We thank them for their sponsorship. Until next time, signing off.